So picking up, and for our holy editor, our friends Brett and Joe, we're picking up from exactly where we left off. So just to finish that thought, Ken had just finished talking about the paradox of humility, right, and audacity that's implicit in divine pride. So I think one of the reasons in the early years, just to pick up on that exact sentence, you know, of unique self, why it ran into such opposition is because people had a hard time, particularly spiritual teachers, and disambiguating, you know, the distinction, you know, between ego and unique self. And lots of the reason was an inability to hold paradox, a kind of, you know, inappropriate neo-Advaita either-or thinking, which didn't really hold the paradox, you know. And the paradox is, the paradox is so important here, because in paradox, you know, in other words, you know, the Garden of Eden, you know, my teacher once said, is not paradise, but paradox.
Yeah.
You know, it's and I'll just give you one great example of it, just to get the quality of paradox. So there's an unbelievable story, Ken, which appears in the Zohar, the Aramaic text, and also the Aramaic text of the Talmud.
Right.
It's an elliptical story, not really commented on a lot, which calls David, King David, the Batchana da Malka in Aramaic, the jester of the king. So why is he the jester of the king? Because David says to God, hey, God, you know, the word in Hebrew is naseni, test me. And God says, you know, in his best Bill Cosby voice, you know, I don't think so, not a good idea. And David says, no, come on, God, test me. You know, and God says, no, I don't think so. And David just insists. So God says, okay. And so David's that night on his rooftop, and he sees Bathsheba, you know, bathing, you know, unclothed. And the whole Bathsheba and David story unfolds, in which, you know, the end of the story is, you know, Bathsheba inappropriately becomes David's wife, her husband's killed, you know, and David commits a number of kind of, you know, cardinal, you know, life mistakes.
Right.
And so then God says to him, you know, you see, you know, I told you not to have you tested. It wasn't a good idea. And David says, well, what do you mean, God? You said I'd fail the test. I said I'd succeed the test. You're the master. I'm the servant. So I failed. Right? You know, and so the Zohar says, and for that reason, David's the jester of the king. So I remember when I first read a version of that story in my lineage master, Mordechai Leiner of Izbica, you know, who is the source of all the unique self and non-dual humanism work, not right. of the post kind, but, you know, within the metaphysical traditions. So, you know, he cites the story a lot and never explains why he cites the story. And then, you know, kind of one night, you know how that is when you're deep inside of a text, one night, like, you know, 10 years after seeing the story for the first time, you know, I'm a little slow on the uptake, I realized, oh, this is about freedom and determinism, of course. And the point is, it's the paradox of choicelessness. You know, you're both choosing all the time, you know, and you're not choosing. It couldn't have been any other way, you know, kind of what Krishnamurti, you know, loved to call choicelessness, and that's the paradox. So the paradox really is total divine pride and total humility,
right.
total audacity and total surrender, you know, in the precise same moment. And I think that's the demarcating characteristic in terms of levels of consciousness, how you can distinguish between someone who's genuinely living their unique self and someone who's caught in some egoic hijacking of unique self.
Right.
It's a nice distinction.
Yeah, it is. And it's that denial we see you know, present in the denial of the unique self as well. And in some cases, it's just a flat-out mistake, because some of these things, you know, do sound contradictory, and we you know, have to just simply hear an explanation to go, oh, yeah, okay, I get it, I agree, that's fine. And other cases are driven by, you know, a deeper dysfunctionalism, almost, which is a failure to realize and deeply acknowledge the infinite nature of the genuine self, and its unique nature appearing in each individual. And so it's another, in some cases, just an innocent mistake, And in some cases, it's part of the structure of the lie that I'm caught in, vis-a-vis my unique self.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fantastic analysis and very, very helpful. I mean, let me throw something at you that it's kind of occurring spontaneously and tell me what you think of it.
Yeah.
If we would apply the dissociation, disidentification, discernment, right, to this issue,
right.
I think what's often happened is when teachers, or not to talk about individual teachers, but to talk about spiritual traditions or, moments in spirit, when they don't disidentify from ego, but they dissociate from ego,
right,
that creates a kind of blindness, right? And that, evolution, you can never evolve beyond ego. What you can do is you can evolve beyond exclusive identification with ego.
That's right.
Right? You can disidentify with ego, but when you dissociate from ego, when you demonize the ego, paradoxically, I think that you're blinded to unique self because you dissociate from anything that's unique.
Yeah.
Right? It's kind of an interesting, in other words, that when you teach a kind of radical, neo-Advaita, let's talk about that tradition, which is a beautiful and a holy tradition. It can be a neo-Advaita tradition in Kabbalah or in a Hindu tradition. It doesn't matter who's doing it. It's that same moment.
Yeah.
When you adopt that kind of position, which completely bashes the ego, then you actually lose your ability to discern the contours of the individuated essence, of the divine mind heart that lives in you and as you, because your dissociation really blinds you.
Yeah, definitely. And that's part of the whole consideration that each individual needs to go through as they begin to honestly confront their unique self.
Yeah. That's beautiful, and to make that discernment. And so, we really identified denial of unique self, right, as a fundamental matrix of shadow formation and pathology.
Yeah.
And you pointed out something else earlier. When you talked about the talk about two other things that you said, and share and get any response before we move on to the next topic. So one was, Maslow's Jonah complex, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, Jonah, for the listeners, by the way, what Ken's referring to is Jonah, one of the books in the biblical canon, right, is asked by the divine voice to go to Nineveh and give a prophecy. And, Jonah takes the next train out of town, right, actually at the seaport in Jaffa near where I used to live. Right, that's where he kind of took the next train, and he said, I don't think so, God. I'm really not doing this. And the text reads, "Vayivrach Yonah milifnei Adonai." Jonah flees from being in the divine presence, and of course, whenever that happens, you wind up in a belly of a whale,
yep.
Spit up on an opposite shore. And
yeah.
So that notion, that kind of the Jonah complex actually of Maslow takes on an enormously deeper resonance when you think of, the Jonah mission being not merely self-actualization, which is critical, but actually, Maslow's later, understanding that you've talked about extensively, self-transcendence.
Right.
That you have a unique expression of self-transcendence. So that's
right.
that kind of deepens our Jonah complex. But,
right.
But then on the practical front, the last point, so what we could actually do is put together this whole conversation, and take the 3-2-1 of shadow, which is a kind of, gold star module, as it were,
yes.
Key in integral spiritual practice, in which you take shadow, as you've integrated this practice from the great traditions, from third person to second person, into first person, you realize, that asshole lives in me,
yeah.
Right? And that kind of, okay. And so that's a kind of integrating of shadow qualities, right, into you. And once you've done that, you can then go 3-2-1-0, and you can realize that those shadow qualities are actually expressions of your unlived life. Because you haven't lived your own unique life, so for example, the shadow quality of, stinginess, right, or of jealousy, right, or of anger, those might all come online, but if you trace those shadow qualities back to their root, to borrow a tantric phrase, what you'll wind up is the shadow qualities are unique. They'll lead you back to your unique shadow, which will lead you back to your unique self. And as I'm jealous because, I'm jealous. I'm not jealous. I've never been jealous in my life, kind of a ballerina. Never happened. Right? But, sometimes I walk into, a bookstore and I say, damn, Wilbur wrote another book? I'm going to die. How many did he do? Right? I thought I wanted to write about that. He did a better job. I hate him. Right? You know, but then that beautiful sense where you kind of, and then when you kind of, you realize it, then you let go of it, and then you say, wow, man, I totally love that guy. He's totally awesome. Right? You know, but unless you do that, unless you can say, man, I can't believe he wrote that book on No Boundary and he said it better than I can. I hate him.
Right?
And then you own it and you say, oh my God, that was his unique self. I totally couldn't have done that. That was his unique self. I get to benefit from that, and that actually will inform and create a scaffolding for me to create my unique self, which might be a unique self book, for example. But unless you do that, unless you take your shadow, which you live in 3-2-1 in first person, and you got to go the next step, which is 3-2-1-0, which is follow your unique shadow back to your unique self. And we've done this over the last 2-3 years, you know, in processes. And Ken, it's just stunning.
I know.
It's just stunning when you actually go from 1 to 0, and you actually realize, no, that's, and it, you know, it's the yellow brick, unique shadows, the yellow brick road, you know, back to unique self. And I'm not sure, by the way, you know, Jung, you know, I've looked at the passages. Sometimes I think he got it totally, and sometimes I'm not sure. I mean, he totally got that shadow was, you know, a nexus into self, but sometimes he talks in, you know, sometimes he kind of gets a unique self kind of idea, and other times he kind of moves away from it, you know, and it, he kind of moves back and forth. So I can never quite figure out, you know, Jung's complex that way, you know, whether he really got a unique self or not. But he, what he didn't get was, which is interesting, he got so much and we're all in his debt in so many ways, you know, but what he didn't get was what I would call the virtue of unique self. You know, he used to say, I'd rather be whole than good.
Yeah,
that's a major Jung quote. Hollis, James Hollis has a really good book where he talks about that quote. But actually, your unique self is your wholeness and your goodness together.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In other words, he had some idea, you know, which was based on his, what you called his, you know, his elevationist move, right? In terms of archetype, he had some idea that either you're going to be either whole, you know, or you're going to be good. Right, and I think it was based on a certain mythic view of religion, which he viewed as making you good and not whole.
Yeah.
You know, and unique self actually invites you to your wholeness and goodness as one.
Yeah.
Like something like that. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's I think that wraps up this piece of it, and let's move on to a whole new topic, and maybe, you know, invite you to start this time, which is creativity. You know, and you know, creativity, you know, that's a big, big topic. You and I talked about it a couple of years back. But if we just kind of talk about, you know, a little bit about, you know, creativity, how it might relate to unique self, and why creativity is just so central, right, in spiritual practice, we begin to revision an integral world spirituality practice.
Yeah, sure. Well, the first thing is that creativity itself is we often think about creativity as confined to humans, and then usually not even all humans, but just the really sort of bright, clever, creative humans. But it's actually one of the main intrinsic fundamental forces of the cosmos, and it's on a the same footing as strong and weak nuclear force and electromagnetic and gravitational. There is at least another force, and that's Eros or creativity or self-organization. And the universe displays the capacity for that and has displayed the capacity for that ever since the Big Bang. And we know this to be true because if there weren't some fundamental creativity present right from the Big Bang forward, then the universe would never have changed from the shape that it was in at the Big Bang, because there was no natural selection and no gene mutation. None of that had there weren't any genes. There wasn't anything for to mutate and be selected, and yet novel forms started appearing, and started appearing instantly. And it was one of Whitehead had what he called categories of the ultimate. They were three things you needed to get the universe running. And one
always
was,
good to know.
Was one, and the second was the many, and the third was the creative advance and the novelty. And that's exactly right. That's a fundamental force. And it's astonishing to see it work. You have, this explosion some 14 billion years ago where literally all of the matter in the universe to this day was created, blew into existence out of, as far as we can tell, nothing, pure emptiness. And so out of that, you get the original sort of fundamental particles, whether they're strings or quarks or whatnot, and they start coming together in unique and creative forms and produce atoms. And atoms wandering around at individuals, and they start coming together and producing molecules. And then you have one of the most mind-boggling creative leaps, which is you have several dozens of really complex molecules. If you can imagine, I mean, just all of a sudden come together a cell wall drops around them and life appears. A life form appears. The first cell appears. And it's an absolute miracle. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable that something like that would happen. But it doesn't stop there. Those cells hang out, for another billion years or so. Then they pull together and start creating multicellular organisms. And in each of these cases, we're seeing the creative advance into novelty. We're seeing creativity, and we're seeing it operate on its own. And when we get to biological forms, Darwin came up with a whole notion of natural selection because he was watching gardeners select different plant forms to cross-pollinate. Because they were then deriving new forms out of that selection. And all that's fine. We just have to remember that selection was an intelligent choice that was made to pull these things together. And Darwin needed some alternative to that. He did consider God, as did George Wallace, who came up with the concept at the same time. And so the both of them would in their own way see evolution as the way that God created a manifest universe. But you have these creative forces operating, and they're just the opposite of randomness. So the idea that you can somehow explain all of the emergence of different biological and psychological forms and so on through random mutation and natural selection is silly. What we see is exactly the opposite of randomness. There's a force in the universe that runs against randomness and got us from dirt to Shakespeare. That is not a random process. That's an extraordinary process of creative evolution. And it's what happens with each of these creative emergence is new qualities, new characteristics, new perspectives, and new degrees of consciousness or awareness come into being. And so, in other words, another divine spark of spirit is struck and appears in each new creatively emergent form. And each of those are, in their own way, unique.
Right.
And even though, all electrons sort of look the same in a certain sense. None of them ever occupy the same space at the same time, and therefore none of them ever have the same prehensive feel of the universe, ever. Each of them has a different prehensive feel of the cosmos. It's a unique holon.
That's right.
And so that uniqueness is part of creativity, and they go hand in hand. And so as evolution continued and creativity continued and more and more levels of consciousness come into being, and each time a new level of consciousness comes into being, new perspectives come into being, new capacities come into being, the universe goes from being close to inert to having sensation and then having perception and then starting to form images with neural nets and then starting to form proto-emotions with reptilian brainstem and then full-fledged emotions with a limbic system. The universe is becoming more and more sensitive to itself. It's seeing itself through different eyes with every stage of unfolding. It's knowing itself through different perspectives from every step of evolution and starting to become more and more and more aware and more and more and more self-aware. And, of course, this is spirit itself starting to wake up. And as we get into human beings, at some point, human beings, in human beings, the process of evolution itself becomes conscious of itself. And creativity becomes aware of creativity. And God becomes aware of God. And this is an extraordinary other leap forward. You sort of have to go back to the beginning of life to get something as comparable. An enormous leap that this was. And what it means is that individuals, as they start to awaken to spirit in themselves and start to awaken to the fact that their self is ultimately one with spirit, and the overall number of spirits is but one. Nonetheless, they're still, just like electrons, none of them occupying the same place, the same space, at the same time. And so every spiritual realization is both identical and unique at the same time. Identical in that it's a realization of the one and only ground of being. And unique in that it's being seen through one set of eyes with one particular perspective for the first time ever. Mm. And so it's the first time that this single ground of being has been seen from this particular angle and through these particular eyes with this particular brain with these particular interpretations and these particular thoughts. And so we're right at the very fundamental edge of evolution itself, because what we have found as we've continued to self-explore is that consciousness is not a product of the brain,
right?
But rather the brain is a product of consciousness. That basically every choice that the human mind makes is transformed into a neural substrate in the brain structure. So we've actually evolved to the point where we can actually catch the mechanism, one of the mechanisms of leading edge evolution, which is the choices that human beings at the edge of evolution make become materialized. They become turned into matter in the brain and passed on. They become they're also passed on through culture, and they're passed on through genetic mutations still, but they're also fundamentally through actual changes in the brain structure. And this happens by the choices, the creative choices that human beings make at the edge of their own evolution. And that means that the unique self is not just a product of the past. It's a creator of the future.
Right.
And we have this. It's Whitehead had kind of a similar notion. I don't want to draw too many parallels here, but he spoke of two different dimensions of God, and most of the wisdom traditions do. But this was in a modern form, and therefore included evolution. One was the primordial nature of God, which is timeless and unchanging, and corresponds for us with emptiness or the true self. And then there's the consequent nature of God, which is the product of changes in the manifest world that are prehensibly unified, drawn into a wholeness, or as Whitehead put it, the many become one and are increased by one. And in other words, another whole on was creatively added to the universe. And that gets laid down in actually new brain structure being created. And so we're right on the edge of being able to spot that form of evolution, and we can spot that it comes from the deepest creative sources of our own self. In other words, it comes from our unique self.
Right.
And so the unique self on the one hand, it does have a consequent nature, because it has enfolded within it all of our previous stages. But it's also a leading edge, where it is laying down the very future of tomorrow. It's
right.
Laying down the creative advance into novelty is getting created as we make our choices and convert them into mental choices, which are converted into brain structures.
Right.
And so creativity is part of how human beings fundamentally participate in the cosmic process of evolution itself. We saw that creativity is not just a human force. It's a cosmic force. It goes all the way back to the Big Bang. And when we participate in that creativity, we're participating in that evolutionary force. And at its highest form, that is issuing straight from the unique self.
Yeah.
And the uniqueness comes with the creativity.
And they're I mean, it's fantastic. And we've talked about this any number of times, and I think this was just the most clear, beautiful, elegant, succinct statement of the whole thing. So I've just completely enjoyed it. Let's just talk about the aesthetic pleasure. I've just enjoyed just and so deep bow and delight. And we have to never forget to delight in things. You know, delight is a function of creativity. So let me just kind of dance in this a little bit, in this elegant, you know, unfolding. And what you're pointing to is the indivisible nexus between unique self and creativity.
Right.
They are actually at their core one and the same, and the matrix of creativity, right, is unique self. You know,
right.
you know, is the unique perspective, right, of the individual, right? But in some sense, we could view or understand the history of the cosmos as both the evolution of and the awakening of uniqueness, right?
Because, that's correct.
Right?
As a spiritual force,
right, precisely. Right, no, precise, critical, end of the sentence. So the evolution of uniqueness, the awakening of uniqueness moving from, we might call unconscious uniqueness to conscious uniqueness,
right,
which then becomes a source of conscious creativity, you know, conscious, you know, in the biggest, broadest sense, not in the kind of Tinsel sense, right, is actually the unfolding and, in some sense, the obvious telos of the cosmos.
Right.
You know, it's not the telos from the perspective of a kind of imposed telos, right? Meaning, you know, prescriptively, this is what the cosmos should be doing. But in a certain sense, one could define world spirituality thought as a move from metaphysics to phenomenology, right? That we're not saying prescriptively this is what should be. We're saying this is what is.
Right.
Right. This is what is. So whether that's in terms of a phenomenology of sexing or whether it's in a phenomenology of reality itself, what is happening is this movement of eros equals creativity equals uniqueness. You know, those are those equal signs, right? Eros equals great. I mean, it's equals creativity equals uniqueness. So, you know, and paradoxically, I want to add something equals pleasure. Right. In other words, pleasure not as only a hedonic function, but as a eudaimonic function. You know, pleasure. You know, with that. You know, that split that they always made between daimon and hedon. Right. Kind of limits pleasure to the aesthetic line. But actually, when you think about it more deeply, there's the pleasure of the good, there's the pleasure of the true, and there's the pleasure of the beautiful.
Right.
Right. And from that perspective, we begin to say and understand. Okay. Now we get this. So there's this beautiful equation of eros. Right, which equals creativity, right, which equals uniqueness, right, which equals the pleasure of creativity, right?
Right.
And it's beautiful in a schema of levels of pleasure that we've talked about offline, I think never online, you know, and when you actually begin to understand that pleasure is a function of the good, the true, and the beautiful, right, and there's no rate of exchange between pleasures, right, as you kind of move up different levels of pleasure, you realize that the kind of highest pleasure, right, meaning nothing below it can buy any of it, right, is the pleasure of unique self-creativity, right, and it builds on true self, right, there's the pleasure of true self-realization, but of course all of true self-realization by itself, without the awakening to unique self, can't buy you any unique self-creativity. You know, in other words, it's its own highest expression, right, of the phenomenological, right, or the descriptive, or just what is, right, of the actual telos of where the cosmos is moving, and we're not making a metaphysical move, we're just making a kind of very simple, implicit kind of, you know, I call it the duh move, D-U-H, duh, right, like, oh, that's what's happening, right, in other words, oh, that's where it's moving, and in that sense, creativity becomes, unique self-creativity becomes an ethical obligation, but again, not a metaphysically imposed ethical obligation of a particular, you know, ethnocentric version, right, that claims that, you know, the world's a particular kind of vending machine that my religion happens to own, right? But rather, right, it's a description of the natural telos of the cosmos. And in that sense, so the prehension, I mean, I love that description of the kind of the unique prehensive feeling of an electron. So although the electron's not writing a book about it,
right,
you know, to the best of our knowledge, right, and I mean, not painting a painting, right, but that unique prehension then explodes into consciousness, you know, billions of years later, you know, when Da Vinci, you know, in his, you know, activates, awakens his unique perspective and produces Da Vinci, you know,
right.
or when Michelangelo or Shakespeare produces Shakespeare, right, you know, and what is an artist?
Right.
And an artist is really someone, right, you know, who's not, you know, we used to think that an artist was someone who was good in art class, right,
you know,
that's what you pointed out in the beginning, is we kind of exiled art, not only to the human realm, right, but to a very particular dimension of the human realm, you draw well, right,
yeah.
You know, but, you know, we're actually creativity is the natural function of perspective. And the more perspectives come online, the more creativity comes online. And then the artist being, you know, the unique person living, you know, and this is kind of, this is Nietzsche plus emptiness, right, if you will, right? Right, you know, Nietzsche plus emptiness, you know, emptiness in the Buddha sense of emptiness, you know, shunyata, right, true self, right? You know, Nietzsche plus true self equals unique self equals the evolutionary artist, right, who is actually seeing through their unique perspective and then offering their unique creativity, and then that unique creativity becomes not just an aesthetic expression in the line of the beautiful, but it becomes a moral obligation, which is not imposed externally, but it's a moral obligation, which is the very natural nature, if you will, right, the very nature of who we are. So that gives you kind of the good, right? And it produces newer and newer advancements into truth, right? You know, the creative advance into novelty, right, as you cited Whitehead, actually reveals deeper and deeper truths about the way it is. And for the first time, you point out, we're actually seeing at the leading edge how that becomes a neural substrate, which begins to give birth to kind of cultural, what you've called cosmic habit,
right?
You know, which creates, you know, and now that we understand neuroplasticity, you know, a little bit better, we actually begin to understand that choice, right? Choice is, right, identical with unique self, right? And we could actually go back to our original equation and say eros, right, equals, you know, creativity, right, equals, you know, uniqueness, equals the pleasure of creativity, right, equals, you know, the creativity which changes the nature of the good, the true, and the beautiful, right? And the linchpin of the entire thing is choice.
Right? It's choice, and choice is creative, and creativity is always involved with uniqueness, because to say that
never split.
Yeah, to say that something is creative means it's produced something new, and something new means something that doesn't exist anyplace
unique.
Else. And that means it's unique,
right?
So
right.
Creativity, by definition, is the creation of unique holons, and that's the fundamental process of evolution itself. Is it continually produces more and more and more conscious and more and more unique, individuated entities. And
gorgeous.
That's exactly tied up with our choice and our actions.
And unique self becomes then literally the very, like, you know, it's, you know, whenever you've got, you know, kind of some great movie where they're kind of looking for the grail, you know, and, you know,
yeah,
some version of the other, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark it's a grail movie in, you know, some shape or form, you know,
yeah,
and the grail in that sense is unique self. Right,
and
unique self is, right, the engine of consciousness. Right, you know, as you say, choice is creative, creativity is unique, newness comes on board, right, and that's the driver of the whole thing. And in that sense, in that precise sense, Gigapandit, we see the weakness of certain forms, you know, of evolutionary spirituality, right, which kind of deface the personal, kind of in that Hegelian sense. I mean, you could call Marx, you know, an evolutionary spirituality person, if you will, you know,
right.
But Marx got rid of, it was his great mistake, right, he got rid of uniqueness. You know, when you read those early dialectical materialists, right, what they're talking about is the human being a cog in this larger process, and the process becomes so preeminent that it actually excludes the personal, because it identifies the personal with personality. But in fact, you realize that that's not only a moral mistake, but it's actually an ontological, it's a post-metaphysical ontological mistake, if I can talk in paradoxical terms, right? In other words, in terms of the ontology of the whole thing from a post-metaphysical perspective, you know, again, paradoxically, right, you actually can't move absolute spirit doesn't move forward unless you actually include uniqueness, right? Not include it, and actually you actually realize that uniqueness is the fundament, you know, as they say in Dutch, it's the fundament, it's the core of the whole thing. And the second you get rid of the personal, or you limit the personal to kind of level one personal and not post-emptiness personal, you know, in the way I would say it, or the way you would say it, to you limit the personal to personal minus, and you don't have a realization of personal plus, right, then you actually lose the essential telos of the universe, gets lost. So all of a sudden we realize that unique self is essential, not merely because every individual has value and dignity. Of course, what could be more important than that? But actually, right, it's also in terms of the larger context, the evolutionary context. The evolutionary context is driven by a process which is essentially in its core personal.
Yeah, you lose that, and it's like working at the post office.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And the post office is bad. Right. Exactly. And I'm kind of hoping that the post office, postal workers union, yeah, not listening to this particular call. But of course, even at the post office, right? You know, you can invest it with unique self. So we want to kind of honor that work. But yes, absolutely. You kind of, and then Ken, what happens is you go postal.
That's
right?
Exactly right.
I mean, that's what, you know, that phrase, you go postal. In other words, the sense of living in a meaningless cosmos, right, creates, in the studies of depression today, there's a really good distinction that you know so well between, my friend Marty Cooper, who's on the World Spirituality Board, is doing really good work on this, between, you know, kind of incidental depression, which is situational, and depression, which comes from a kind of what I would call a deconstruction of self.
Yeah.
Right. Which is a kind of vortex that sucks you in, that can actually not be healed. I mean, it can be treated by drugs pharmacologically, but it can only be healed by a kind of fundamental transformation of self.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and which means a kind of owning, you know, getting over the lie, getting over the denial of unique self that we talked about earlier. Right, is really the only way to approach the what really is today, from a statistical perspective, you know, a malaise. I mean, it's really a kind of, you know, when you see those movies about the kind of the creeping ooze, you know, there's a creeping cultural malaise, this kind of, you know, George Steiner's ennui, but the ennui comes from an inability to realize that I'm actually more than just my lower right or upper right structure, than my kind of physical, you know, determined structure, that I'm a self with choices, right, which invests me with the dignity of infinite creativity moving through me, that gives birth, right, to new God, right, to new cosmos, right, to newness, right, which allows me to get up in the morning. Because otherwise, as you say, you're in the post office and you wind up going postal. You know, like if we could. Yeah.
As Alan Watts used to say, reality is what the world looks like on a bleak Monday morning on the way to work.
Blessings to Alan Watts, man.
But there are a lot of factors that fight that realization, and there's cultural blindness and cultural nexus of lies about who you are and what you're allowed to be. There are individual repression and individual lies and shadows about what you are, what you're allowed to be, what you can't be. And there's an enormous number of factors that conspire in the lie. And those aren't easy to tackle. They also involve, if it was even in a culture that didn't lie about the unique self, there's still the whole process of overcoming the finite psychological structures that screen out the infinite and screen out absolute awareness, and that has to be realized through a whole process of meditative reawakening. So from natural causes to dysfunctional, cultural oppressive causes to psychologically repressive causes, there's an enormous number of factors that contribute to the lie. And working through those almost has to be done sort of, one step at a time. Okay, this, right, check that out, that's not true. This, check that out, that's not true. This, check that, that's not true. And you go through lie after lie after lie until you come to the realization of who and what you really are. And it's not a simple or easy process.
Yeah.
In some ways, it's very easy. As Tibetans say, too easy to believe.
Right.
But for just that reason, it can be a complex practice to make this recognition, because it's not just a simple recognition of the ever-present self-liberated self, but it's overcoming all of the active lies that are present, so to speak, in all four quadrants. So it can be a bit of a difficult go.
Which is, a bit of a difficult go, which is, I think, really why, the attempts that have been made, kind of in the separate self world to do typology, most typologies today are, in some sense, separate self typologies, meaning they're a typology of your separate self egoic structure, and they have value. Right,
yeah.
They have value at that level of consciousness, and they're important. But that's not the unique self process.
Right.
The unique self process can't become another version of separate self typology, or we actually haven't moved the needle, right, in any way. Right,
right.
A unique self process has to, you essentially described implicitly or explicitly, the dimensions of unique self process, and it has to deal with, disambiguating or discerning, the cultural lies. It's
right.
Got to discern the familial, the family systems, lies. It has to discern, the self-deceptions that Freud said that even the simple person was a genius at. But that's not enough. It then has to then do the practices, that actually, the enactments that actually realize the true nature of reality,
right.
Actually realize the fullness of the emptiness, right, that realized true self. Right? And then, right, when you've done all that, then what happens? Then your unique self begins to spontaneously emerge, and you then have to do work on a kind of what we might call a post-emptiness typological work, where you really, discern from that place, from that perspective, the nature of what your unique perspective can see, and you begin to realize, and that's where the joy comes into play. When you begin to really awaken at that place, you realize the great joy of being the eyes of God.
Right.
The great joy of being, God's verb. The great joy of being, God's adjective, maybe even dangling modifier on a good day, right? in other words, and that really comes online. And when you then add to it, if in some sense the universe is awakening to uniqueness, and if we actually understand, and to bring kind of two topics to bear here, we understand that one face of love, right, love in the inner subjective context. There's love as the force of the cosmos that you described earlier, right? And then there's, as kind of the third person of love, there's being lived as love, right? First person of love, I am love, right? That expression of I am. And then there's the inner subjective context. We love each other. And in the inner subjective context, right, love is a perception, both of first and third person love and of, the infinite other, the face. Levinas is, term from biblical text, right, that lives in front of me. Love is a perception, and so then self-love can, right, becomes, of course, a self-perception. And so then if we take the whole sweep, we just talked about, so the evolution of God is actually the evolution of divine self-love, right?
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
Right, it's gorgeous. It just sends shivers, through every cell, right? It's just like, wow, it's the divine awakening in the manifest, of course, right? Awakening to self-knowing, right? Which is self-perception, right? Which is self-love, right? And to realize that my awakening to my unique self participates in an unmediated and direct way, right? In the self-love of divinity, of all that is, right? Which changes the very fundament of reality, right? Well, it's a pretty good reason to get up in the morning, and it might even get you through a bleak and dreary Monday morning.
It's just a pretty good foundation for divine pride.
And it's a pretty good, right? Wow. Yeah. and it's a pretty good foundation for divine pride. And that's why we just, and I want to raise another topic and turn it to you, but we just need to enlarge our terms here. You know, when we exile, if I can use kind of, I'm using it a kind of in a Kabbalistic, you know, form. Walter Benjamin loved this kind of phrase, right?
Yeah.
We exile love, you know, to that limited, you know, human emotion that you feel to a very small list of people who happen to also, if you look at it carefully, being providing you with your egocentric security, or you have a biological connection to it with, you know, you've got this very, you know, narrow love list, and love just means, oh, either my mom or dad on a good day after I've gone to therapy, right?
Sure.
Maybe, right? You know, or someone that I have this kind of, you know, awakened, you know, neurochemical response to, so I'm falling in love, which kind of goes away at a certain point, and that becomes all of love. We've literally exiled love.
Yeah.
You know, and to liberate love, right, and to actually understand love as the natural expression of God looking at God, because, of course, if love is a perception, perception only comes through the vehicle of your unique perspective, you know, and your unique perspective is the process of awakening to your unique self is clarifying God's perspective that lives in you, as you, and through you, and therefore to love God is to let God see through your eyes.
That would do it.
That would do it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would do it. Wow. Wow, 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 wow. Yeah, no, it just changes everything. It just changes everything. It just changes everything. So maybe let's hit the last topic.
Okay.
How you doing? We okay for one last topic here? Yeah, okay?
Sure.
Okay. So if you're Jewish, by the way, when you say the last topic, you really mean topic and a half. I'm just kind of sharing that with you. Okay. Right? So, you know, as I've kind of looked at this, you know, I'll knock everything off the list, just these last things. So one is unique self and sexuality, you know, kind of
right.
A unique self tantra.
Right.
You know, it just seems important to touch base on and just say a word on it and turn it over to you, right, which is, you know, when we talk about a phenomenology of sexuality, or as our colleague David Data likes to call it, sexing.
Right.
I think that's his phrase. I don't know if that's Adida original, but it's a nice way of saying it. You know, a phenomenology of sexing. You know, on the one hand, you've got separate self-sexing, you know, which is often a kind of cover-up. You know, it's kind of like you go for the refrigerator when you're feeling bad. And so, you know, sexing or gossiping, you've kind of got, you know, a form of separate self-fooding and separate self, you know, gossiping and separate self-sexing, which is a kind of comfort sexing. You know, and you know, let's not knock comfort, right? You know, comfort's a good thing, you know, but it's not pleasure. You know, it's, you know, it's the opposite of, you know, pain, right, is of course not pleasure. The opposite of pain is comfort. You know, you can avoid pain your entire life and you'll get comfortable, you know, as in comfortably numb, you know, but you'll never get the pleasure. So comfort sexing, you know, doesn't quite get you there. You know, vital sexing, you know, an expression of the evolutionary drive in us is beautiful, but you got to choose your partner carefully,
right?
Because otherwise you're going to create a mess,
right?
So there's that. You know, and then there's of course true self tantra, you know, which is of course, you know the idea of, you know, I'm going to you know, fuck you open to God, fuck myself open to God, right? And that kind of, you know, phrase, you know, of our colleague, but basically it's a classical, you know, Eastern view of, you know, sexuality becomes a vehicle. It's impersonal, essentially, right? It's a vehicle to open you up to the divine, which is gorgeous and important. But there really are, you know, and of course there's you know, pleasure sexing, which is, you know, sexing for the sake of pleasure, which can operate on a separate self level, right? Or it can be on a true self level. You can actually sex in true self, right? Through sexing to actually feel the interior face of divinity, which is pleasure, which is goodness.
Sure.
You can actually feel that through sexing. So pleasure sexing can operate either on a separate self or on a true self level. But none of that gets us to what we might call unique self tantra. And unique self tantra is something else. Unique self tantra is the ability to move beyond separation, to move beyond loneliness, and to feel the full realization and expression of your unique self, right? You know, as you merge and receive another unique self, right, in this, you know, unrepeatable, you know, you know, gorgeous incandescent meeting, which is not, again, that's not the transcendent sex, right, of true self that, for example, Jenny writes about. Jenny Wade, you wrote a beautiful introduction to that book, if I recall, right, on transcendent sex. But Jenny's talking about true self sexing,
right?
Unique self sexing means that I actually transcend my loneliness, right, in this moment with you in a way. I transcend alienation, and I actually experience myself as a unique child of the universe, birthing into my unique oneness, right, in a way in which all alienation disappears in that moment of sexing, and there's a complete recognition, there's a complete, you know, holding, there's a complete losing of self in one moment, right, and that's the paradox of it. Paradox just goes through our entire conversation. The very moment that you lose self, right, in orgasm, which is a play, by the way, in Hebrew, or mugzam, extreme light, right, is the, you know, right, in the extremity of the light, you're born. You disappear and you're born, you know, in kind of the self-same moment. That's a unique self-tantra, right? And that's a whole other practice, which is, I think, different than the classical Eastern tantra. It builds on it, but it's something beyond it. And so therefore, unique self needs to become part of the sexuality story, where I move beyond comfort sexing of separate self. I move beyond true self-tantra. I'm not merely doing vital sexing, as beautiful and as legitimate as that is. All of these are phenomenologically possible and in the right context, you know, appropriate, and you need to discern the context. But we want to move towards a kind of evolutionary sexing, which would be a kind of unique self-tantra, where through that unique self-merging, I actually open up to all, and then maybe the last sentence, Mega K, is I give birth to, you know, kind of post-unique self-tantra, I give birth to a kind of evolutionary tantra, where kind of my sexing itself becomes a form of prayer, right? But prayer not only for my kind of limited needs, but it becomes, sexing itself becomes a prayer, right, for the cosmos and as the cosmos.
Uh-huh.
But it's the cosmos, you know, in prayer, right? It's, you know, I call it sometimes tikkun, using that Kabbalistic word, tikkun sexing, where it's the cosmos itself coming together in the unique merger of masculine and feminine, which is itself a prayer, which is itself, right, a gesture towards, right, higher and higher levels of mutuality, recognition, union, and embrace. And so we add on here a kind of unique self-tantra and a kind of, you know, evolutionary or bodhisattva or tikkun tantra, which really changes, Mega K, the face of sexuality and expands it, deepens it. The game changes.
Yeah, I think so. In a certain sense, tantra is sex plus real eros.
Mm.
And because real eros is transcendence, which means a creativity, which means uniqueness, and the pleasure of God, all wound up into one package. And we don't, none of those other forms of sexing that you mentioned actually has a true eros component. They're in a bastardized form called erotic, but that's at best the fleshy, is confused with the kind of fleshy eroticism, which isn't what real eros is. Real eros is operating from the moment of the Big Bang to the moment of realization and forward. And it's the activation of real eros via a sexuality that makes it so unique, and the uniqueness is, of course, part of the unique self, and it's the actualization of eros as transcendence and creativity and uniqueness and the pleasure of God, all of that coming in the actual act of sexuality. So it's a sort of hooking certain things up that aren't hooked up until they're consciously chosen to be hooked up. I mean, you have to, you don't, a real tantric sexuality is not something you accidentally stumble on. It's something that you consciously, and it's something you have to do in awareness, and it's something that has to involve the unique self as a foundation of the partner.
Mega K.
Yeah.
As you said, the pleasure of God, I think the intensity of the eros, just, I'm not sure, just disconnected even Brett's great phone line. right. So picking up right there. So the pleasure of God and the eros of
Well, yes, it's just these things all need to be brought together, and then they're not done so accidentally. It's something that has to be done with intentionality and a connecting with the unique self, or certainly as absolutely close as one possibly can, because the idea of the sexuality part is that bodily currents, subtle energy currents, are going to be activated that are not usually activated outside of something like sexuality. Only they're usually activated by a self or self sense that is not unique or and not even divine.
Right.
Rarely even the true self. And yet those currents are very powerful expressions or concrete examples, we could say, of what real Eros is. Real Eros does in the entire cosmos what sexuality does in the human body.
Right.
And so putting those two together in an intentional fashion allows the sexuality to actually enhance one's awareness of the unique self. And that's always been one of the secrets of Tantra, even with its certain limitations, is that using concentration forms that involved a sexual component, the mind always gravitated towards that component with a greater facility and quickness and ease and desire. And so you could get into states of consciousness that were harder to get into than by, let's say, counting your breath.
Right.
Because every state of consciousness is supported by a particular energy, then you can activate a particular state by mentally concentrating on it or by activating that energy. And
right.
Tantra's always said, we're gonna activate the energy, and here's how you do it. And then there follows, you know, the several exercises that involve the awakening of bioenergy, subtle energy in the human body, and its conduction up and down certain meridians in the body and whatnot. And those are then eliciting these higher states of consciousness. And in a sense, the same process can occur because you're by consciously evoking Eros, by consciously evoking transcendence and uniqueness and creativity, the pleasure of God, intentionally putting all of these in mind and then allowing the body to respond to those, is to intensify those components,
right?
And to bring forth that state of consciousness in an even fuller and brighter and shinier fashion.
Beautiful.
And so what everything has been present in a lot of the traditional forms of Tantra except the unique self.
Right, exactly.
And,
yeah, exactly.
And so that's – but that does tend to change a lot of things because the ultimate state of consciousness that you're aiming for is different.
Right.
And so the state of consciousness that you're going to be bringing forth and advancing and evolving and connecting with is not going to be the true self, but the unique self.
Unique self, right.
And Eros is capable of doing that.
Right.
It's just that that's the form that Eros operates at the unique self level.
Right.
And so we're just here to say, well, at that unique self level, there's a form of Eros that corresponds to that.
Right.
And
which naturally
you
right.
can find it in sex.
Right. Exactly. Which beautiful. Which naturally creates or demands, you know, the emergence, right, of a unique self tantra.
Absolutely.
Another, right. And as we can't, you know, and I'm just going to say just a bracketed sentence. I'm not sure to all of our good listeners why the phone's gone in and out a couple of times. We have a great line. So if it does, Ken, I'll just call back in. Just we'll have that kind of policy. It seems to be going out. I'm not sure why. It seems to be disconnecting me and not you, which must mean that you've just kind of got a higher Eros connectivity wave going on today. So I'm not exactly sure what that is. I'll check in with Brett. So on this, I'm just to kind of feel into it for a second. You know, the nature of when you kind of think about the enormous amount of pain around sexuality.
Yeah.
You know, the enormous amount of, you know, I mean, it's the excuse for every war, you know, from Trojan Wars before and afterwards. You know, it's the amount of kind of, you know, not only kind of, you know, real political problems, but, you know, just the amount of shame and the amount of just destruction. I mean, you know, one could easily identify the Iraq War, which probably wasn't a great idea, to, you know, Bill Clinton's engagement with Monica, which prevented him from campaigning for Al Gore. Right, which, you know, meant that even though Al Gore won the election, he kind of lost it because, you know, et cetera, that entire story from years back. And I mean, but actually, that's not an inappropriate conclusion. In other words, Bill Clinton, had the country not obsessed over the Bill Clinton-Monica issue, he wouldn't have been impeached. And of course, paradoxically, you know, I don't know if you caught on Bill Clinton gave actually a really great speech at the Democratic Convention in 2012, a few days ago, and he had one line in it, which I think everybody missed. But he said, you know, the brass of people who attack someone for something they're doing themselves, right?
Yeah.
Which, of course, what he was referring to is the fact, which Laura Kipnis in her book A Female Thing points out in an entire chapter, that every single person that attacked Bill Clinton, you know, from Newt Gingrich on down, you know, in the committee for impeachment, every one of them was involved in some, you know, non-classical, you know, publicly problematic sexual engagement. You know, so people use, you know, they use sex, right, and all the reasons, the ways that sex is used, because why is sex available to be used in that way, right? I think it's because sexuality doesn't fit naturally into the separate self, right?
Yeah.
And as it's so large, it's so part of, it's so obviously part of a larger Eros.
Right.
It's so obviously part of a larger context, and it so demands, you know, that a person – leave, you know, separate self behind, you know,
right.
And so, and that's why, you know, when you look at the literature of victim feminism, you know, when you look at some of those, there's been some really, a couple of really good lines I saw, where, you know, really good perspectives, which point out simply that, you know, all sexuality takes place in the context of this larger desire, of this larger flow of Eros. And so therefore, what makes sense in that sexual context, assuming that it's an ethical and appropriate context, right, doesn't make sense when you're retelling the story as separate self, right? You know, how many people want, you know, replayed on the front page of the New York Times, you know, exactly how they're reacting at a particular moment of sexuality, right? Right? Because it doesn't make sense out of that context, because you're going back into a separate small self context, and sexing by its nature is not a separate small self activity.
Right.
Right? Right? And that's precisely its greatness. And it's precisely why, if you actually can access it and bring it into a larger context, you can experience, you know, not merely the kind of, you know, minimal spasmodic, you know, 13-second pleasure of what today is called an orgasm, but you can actually feel through the pleasure, right, to, you know, it's the pleasure of God, it's the pleasure of divinity,
right.
And
right.
Feel it as its core source, and then add unique self on, and then realize that it all changes through unique self, right, then that pleasure then becomes the portal, the opening, right, to creativity, and it's, of course, not by creativity, which is a function of, as we've just talked about, choice and unique self, and they're inseparable. And of course, then you kind of have this really simple, you know, either an aha moment, AHA, or a dumb moment, DUH, whichever one you want to pick, which is, oh, that's why sexuality is the ultimate creative act, right? Right? And whether it's producing a child or not, you know, every mystical tradition understood sexuality as being creative, that
right.
Every sexual act creates something. Sometimes
right.
It creates a child.
Right.
Right. But sexuality by its nature is inherently creative. Right. It changes something. And so unique self tantra begins to come on board. And then maybe the last sentence on this, Mega K, is that then when you go into sexuality, when you kind of go into its nature, into its, if you will, the details, right,
right.
You know, kind of how it works. So you actually begin to realize again that the good, the true, and the beautiful, you know, are inter-included lines that produce something new and larger than it. You know, actually in that, you know, little private email exchange we had with our friend Evan, I mean, that's what he was kind of pointing to that, and you, of course, point to it, you know, in any number of ways throughout your writing, that the good, the true, and the beautiful are inter-included.
Right.
That's if I'm kind of loosely translating a phrase from Kabbalah, Kalalut, right? You know, they're inter-included. There's the good of the true and the good of the beautiful and the good of the good and the true of the true and the true of the beautiful and the true of the good, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so in that sense, sexuality, which seems to be, you know, it's both an aesthetic line, obviously. It's the beautiful. And it's,
right.
First, it's eros in first person. But it's also the true and the, you know, it's also the true and the good. So for example, and just a you know, a couple of just very simple examples. You know, I mean, normally, you know, if you go to your local Wells Fargo bank in Denver and you ask them to withdraw money, you know, from the Wilbur account, and then you say, hey, and do me a favor, credit my account, don't debit it. So the first time they laugh, you know, uh-huh, that was really funny. You ask it a few more times, you get thrown out of the bank, even if you are Ken Wilber, right? You just do, right? Right? Because we all know, right, that either you're taking money from your account or you're putting money into your account, but you can't be doing both at the same time, other than in sexing,
right?
Right? And in sexing, right, that entire separate self split, that egoic split between giving and receiving, literally disappears.
Right.
Right. And the giver becomes the receiver, and the receiver becomes the giver, right? And a higher order of reality is intimated, you know, which is this larger eros that you're talking about. And so the good, right, the ethical principle of giving and receiving being one is actually inherent in the beautiful and reveals, right, a new truth about the nature of reality. And so I think at the higher levels of eros, you know, one of the beautiful things is the good, the true, and the beautiful come on board. Unique self and true self, you know, kind of merge as one. And it seems like, you know, and maybe to turn to you for a closing, you know, as we kind of wind down here, that this is why, you know, unique self becomes a kind of first principle. Not the only first principle. You never want to dogmatically something, but it's a first principle, you know, of world spirituality. Because unique self really transcends any particular tradition, right? It's available to everyone, right? It mirrors, you know, world spirituality emerges from a phenomenological description of the nature of reality. You know, we don't just not know things, right? You know, we used to think we knew everything. If you kind of give a kind of phenomenal, you know, kind of description of levels, you know, first we thought we knew everything. Well, maybe do even better, Ken. First, we didn't know anything. Then we kind of emerge, right? And we kind of develop systems, right? So maybe let's call that, you know, in a rough term, the religions. So they're filled with certainties, you know, at least in their exoteric form. Then the religions are challenged, in the ways that they're challenged, you know, see all of Ken Wilber on, you know, the kind of critiques of modernity and postmodernity, you know, of the great traditions, or to their challenge. So then a kind of new uncertainty, right, emerges, right? And then that's kind of level three. Then level four, well, then, you know, flatland science claims to be the only purveyor of certainty, but everything else is kind of, you know, kind of left uncertain, right? This guy, we have nothing to say. And then we kind of make this integral move and we reclaim an enacted eye of the spirit that can actually give us not dogmatic certainty, but a kind of felt first, second, and third person knowing about the nature of what is, even if at the end of all that knowing is the is unknowing,
right.
But it doesn't remove the knowing, right? In other words,
right.
That notion that, you know, the only grand narrative of modernity is that there's no grand narrative and that we can't know anything, right, leaves us denuded and hopeless and lost in a lie, and that we actually can begin in a world spirituality, right, to establish first principles that are a reflection of the nature of reality as we know it. And if there's any gift, you know, that, you know, we'd like to maybe give to the world, you know, through a world spirituality based on integral principles, you know, and, you know, and it's, I think, why John Mackey is backing the book by that name, because I think he sees how important it is this new notion of knowing. You know, this new notion of knowing which unique self, you know, and the experience of my creative unique self as a unique expression of the Eros of the cosmos, you know, being essential, and that's the great integral gift. You know, unique self is a natural function of integral.
Right.
You know, and that's just such a necessary and gorgeous gift. You know, so unique self, I mean, that's you know, passing over to you to close, kind of, you know, offering the notion of unique self, you know, as a first principle of world spirituality.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to stop. And I think that's beautifully said. And it holds open or stays away from a kind of absolutistic dogmatism, but it still asserts the fact that an ongoing knowing is capable. Human beings are capable of that. And that knowing, like everything else, will evolve. So that evolutionary concept of knowing removes the necessity to be certain for all time. And
right.
Simply says, this is something that I can know now, and we'll see what it looks like tomorrow.
Right.
And that gives us both knowing and an openness. And so we're doing fine.
Yeah.
And we can construct an entire system based on what we're capable of knowing right now.
Right.
And you know, let tomorrow worry about itself. What we don't want to do is get caught in the performative contradiction of claiming that we can't know anything, because that's a absolutistic claim to absolute knowledge. And we're saying we absolutely can't know anything. I know that absolutely. Well, that's just a self-contradiction, a performative contradiction. You're claiming, you're giving yourself the right kind of knowledge you're taking away from everybody else. And religion, unfortunately, has gotten into that conundrum because so much of it is mythic literal and absolutistic in its nature, and that's why we talk about doing an integral post metaphysics or a post mythic approach to divine realities, and that allows us back into the game without the contradictions and the problems that have been traditionally associated with religion. We just don't have to do that. That's all very, you know, it's a new day, it's a new approach, and it's looking very very strong in its what it has to offer.
Yeah. No, that's both a conclusion and a blessing. And,
absolutely.
Yeah, and just we'll finish here. Ken, I think I said earlier, we don't delight enough in the world. So I just want to just delight in the conversation, not just to enjoy it, but to really just delight in it and the newness that emerges from it every time. And, you know, mega love to Giga K.
You got it, buddy.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Next time.
Uh-huh.